If you spend any amount of time online like I do, you've probably heard of a little website called Reddit.com. And just within the past month, Reddit decided that they were going to give away $1 million of their ad revenue. And the way that they were going to give out that money was to let the users of the website vote on what their favorite charitable organizations were. And out of all the charities in the world, the Freedom From Religion Foundation is in the top 10 most valuable. People of the internet have spoken. So I guess we're quite fortunate today to have not one, but two staff attorneys from the FFRF here to speak to us today. Andrew Seidel and Patrick Elliott work tirelessly defending the separation of church and state. They're fighting this battle at local school boards, local state governments, and even taking up the national government with a lot of very important lawsuits. They're also great friends of AHA, and they've been mentors for us for many years. So let's give them a warm welcome.
Okay. So real quick, two announcements. First, all you students, high school, college, graduate students, FFRF has a couple of essay contests that you can enter. We know it's hard being a poor student, so we're giving out $3,000 first prize, $2,000 second prize. There's information on our table out there. The Jesus-like gentleman who just introduced us is a former winner. I'm a former winner, so check it out. It's worth doing. And second, also on that table are internship applications or information for FFRF. We are looking for undergraduate interns. It's close to campus. It's a really fun job. You can ask Sam. He's done some for us before. Oh, yeah, I was looking for it. All right. So I'm Patrick. I'm Andrew. This is Patrick. We're attorneys at FFRF. Over the past 2 years, we have received more than 5,000 complaints about state church issues. And that's what we want to talk to you about today, about what Thomas Jefferson called violations of the wall of separation between state and church. So notice that he said a wall, right? He didn't talk about a fine line that was easily overstepped. This is a wall. It's supposed to be tall and strong and impregnable. Okay? That's not how it's looked at in our society. It's looked at as sort of an optional thing. And in our experience, a lot of people in this movement don't see the value in protecting this wall. And if they do see the value in it, they don't understand what it is that they can do to protect it. So that's what we're going to talk about today. I'm going to talk about why you should care about keeping state and church separate. And then Patrick's going to talk a little bit about what you can do, what you as individuals, as students, can do to help. And it's a little more than liking things on Facebook. Okay? That's easy. It's kind of a lot like praying, though. You know, it's all about you. It's not as effective as some of the things that you can do. So that's, we're going to give you a new toolbox, some things that you can use to help protect the wall of separation. Now, last year, Barry Cosman, who's a demographer about our movement, did a study of college students, a survey. And he asked them, first of all, to identify their worldview. Are you religious? That's the red bars. Do you consider yourselves secular? That's the blue bars. Or do you consider yourselves spiritual? That's the yellow bar. Then those people were asked to identify what the word secularism meant to them. And it didn't have to be one thing. It could be multiple things. So it means no identification, the absence of supernatural religious beliefs, separation of state from state and church, or atheism down there at the bottom. Now, look closely at that middle one. That's the only one where secularists score way lower than everybody else. And it's the separation of state and church. So that suggests that in this movement, the people who consider themselves secular don't value that anywhere near as much as, say, some of the other folks. It's just suggested, it doesn't prove it. But this is incredibly important. First of all, the only way you ever get genuine religious freedom is by upholding the wall of separation. By keeping religion out of government and keeping government out of religion, that's the only way to guarantee true religious freedom. But more importantly, whatever issue it is that you care about, fighting to defend that wall will help on that particular issue. Now, I'm not saying that the Jeffersonian wall is a panacea, that it will cure absolutely every ill. But fighting to uphold it will affect other movements in very real ways. And that's what I'm going to talk to you about. So some of the impacts that protecting the wall of separation can have are pretty obvious. If you're for LGBT equality, keeping religious views and religious zealots out of our government is going to help you get equal rights. I mean, the only rationale that is out there, and it's not a good rationale, is that the Bible says marriage is between a man and a woman. That's it. That's what every one of these boils down to. So you fight that, you keep religion out of government, and you're helping the LGBT movement. So here's another obvious one, women's rights. This is actually one of the reasons that FFRF was started in the first place. There are a few Wisconsin feminists who recognize that religion is the biggest barrier to women's rights and equality. Elizabeth Cady Stanton, I'm sure you all remember her, she actually had to rewrite the Bible because she recognized that religion was the biggest stumbling block. So this is part of the Women's Bible, chapter 2. This is a real excerpt. This is where she's rewriting the story of Eve being crafted and created from one of Adam's ribs, just being sort of a subsidiary of man. And she wrote that the Bible, the church, they have been the greatest block in the way of woman's development. It is not to the Bible, prayer books, catechisms, liturgies, the canon law, and church creeds and organizations that woman owes one step in her progress, for all these alike have been hostile and still are to her freedom and development. I mean, I hope I don't have to draw the line between anti-abortionists who believe that a woman's body belongs to her husband or to God, and how keeping that viewpoint out of government and out of our laws will help if you are for women's rights. But let's move on to one that's a little less obvious. LGBT rights, women's rights, pretty obvious. What about something like the environment? So I majored in neuroscience and environmental science. When I went to law school, I got a certificate in environmental law. I won an award for excellence in environmental law. I've worked in two environmental law clinics at law schools. I've sued oil companies for violating the Clean Air Act. I got a master's of law in environmental law. I happen to be an avid nature photographer. I think the bottom line I'm trying to point out is that I love the environment. The environmental movement is very, very important to me. But that is actually one of the reasons that I came to work at FFRF. I was talking with my sister after I got the offer, and I was saying, you know, I'm trying to build this environmental law practice in Colorado, but I've got this great opportunity. And she pointed out, she said, well, if you're keeping state and church separate, aren't you going to be helping the environmental movement? And she's absolutely right. And if you keep religious views out of government and religious views out of our laws, it's going to change the way we approach environmental issues. And you may not believe that, so I'm going to try to prove it to you. Jim Inhofe chairs the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee. Here he is on the floor of the Senate discussing global climate change. He sounds like a total jackass. He's disproving global warming because he found a snowball outside. And the reason that he is like this, and he actually, first of all, in January of 2005, he said that global warming is the second largest hoax ever played on the American people. Anybody know what the first is? The separation of state and church. But more recently, he said this. My point is, God's still up there. The arrogance of people to think that we can alter the environment. He's citing to the Bible when he says this. He actually cites to Genesis 8. Anybody know their Bible that well? This is when God promises Noah that he's never going to flood the earth again after the flood. So that's why we don't have to worry about global warming. Global climate change isn't an issue because there's never going to be another flood. Seas aren't going to rise. Don't worry about it. The Bible says so. I have another video coming up. We'll see if that works. The next video is Representative Shimkus from Illinois. He also cites to Genesis 8. And this is actually from a few years ago. He's out of office now. This is the House of Representatives subcommittee hearing on energy and the environment.
But we do have members of the clergy here as members of the panel. So I want to start with Genesis 8, verse 21 and 22. Never again will I curse the ground because of man, even though every inclination of his heart is evil from childhood, and never again will I destroy all living creatures as I have done. As long as the earth endures, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night will never cease. I believe that's the infallible word of God, and that's the way it's going to be for his creation. The second verse comes from Matthew 24, and he will send his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather his elect from the four winds, from one end of the heavens to the other. The earth will end only when God declares it's time to be over. Man will not destroy this earth. This earth will not be destroyed by a flood.
Citing the Bible. Now, some of you may still not believe this, so we're going to do a quick thought experiment. Okay? So imagine that the world is ending tomorrow. We know this to be true. There's a meteor the size of Asia heading our way at 72 kilometers a second. There is absolutely no reprieve. We are all going to die. The earth is done. What do you care about? Do you care about greenhouse gases? Do you care about a couple inches of the sea going up? Do you care about melting polar ice caps or the Pacific trash island? Probably not. And that's the mindset of a good chunk of this country. 41% of this country believe that Jesus is coming back in the next 40 years, and he's bringing Armageddon with him. If you can't get them to care about beyond 40 years, you're not going to get any change in environmental policy in this country. So that's the mindset that we're fighting. And on a related subject, animal rights. An Argentinian court recently declared that an orangutan, a non-human person, has freedom. Right to freedom, excuse me. There was a similar case in New York involving a chimpanzee. The court made the opposite finding. Peter Singer, professor of bioethics at Princeton, and an atheist, is kind of leading the charge on this. And real quick, I know those are not orangutans or chimpanzees. They're the only pictures I have of they're gorillas. I took them. Anyway, just keep your angry questions to yourself at the end about that. Anybody want to take a guess at the mindset that's underlying at least some of the opposition to animal rights? Come on, it's pretty... Yeah, that's exactly it. Peter Singer wrote an article for The Guardian entitled "Religion's Regressive Hold on Animal Rights Issues." There's Ken Ham talking about the New York case. Wesley Smith, everybody know the Discovery Institute? This is the intelligent design think tank. Wesley Smith there wrote that our accelerating rejection of the Judeo-Christian worldview, which upholds the unique dignity and worth of human beings, that rejection is what is causing animal rights. He goes on to say that once we knocked species off the pedestal of exceptionalism, it was only logical that we would see fauna and flora as entitled to rights. Basically, what they're saying is that God created people, and he gave us dominion over everything. If you continue to read this, that's what it comes up in. And that's actually part of a larger debate, evolution and creationism, which brings us to the next thing that keeping the wall of separation, state and church, tall and strong will help. If you want better sex education, if you want better history education, keeping this wall tall and strong will help. Did anybody see what happened in Oklahoma in the past couple months with their AP history classes? Yeah, they shot them down because Representative Dan Fisher, who is a member of the Black Robed Regiment, Black Robed Regiment is a group whose aims include to educate all people and to restore to its rightful place the church in America, indeed the entire earth. They're going to provide educational materials for use to the American public so as to restore what has been lost by way of deception and historical revisionism. So it's only with religion that ignorance means education. Better science education is the obvious issue here. If we want accurate science about global climate change, about evolution, about biology taught in public schools, then getting religion out of government has got to be our number one priority. And there's one other way religion is infiltrating the education system in this country, and actually a bigger issue than anything I've brought up so far. Anybody know what it is? Want to take a guess? Vouchers. Vouchers, hundreds of millions of dollars that are supposed to go to the public schools are being taken out of the public schools and given to private religious schools. Patrick is actually our expert in-house on vouchers. How much money is Wisconsin giving away annually now?
Roughly $200 million.
$200 million from public schools to private schools. Healthcare, another big one. Who are the biggest opponents of universal healthcare? Who is against the woman's right to choose? Against death with dignity? Against stem cell research that'll cure ALS and blindness and spinal cord injuries, multiple sclerosis? And why are they opposed? Because humans can't alter God's plan. I mean, in some cases, religion is against healthcare altogether. 43 of the 50 states actually have exemptions from child abuse statutes for religious parents. What that means is that if you are a parent and your daughter has diabetes and you don't think insulin will help her, but you think prayer will, you can pray for her. And when she dies, like 8-year-old Sybil Rossiter did, you are not criminally negligent. Now, Sybil's parents, and she lived in Oregon, so they're going to jail because Oregon is one of the 7 states that doesn't have this exemption. But just across the border, in Idaho, this is an enormous problem. There are entire cemeteries full of kids who have been prayed for instead of given medical treatment. Christy Perry, a state representative in Idaho, just defended the exemption by saying, "If I want to let my child be with God, why is that wrong?" In 2007, Christopher Hitchens spoke at the FFRF convention. He was given one of our awards. And he pointed out that the genital mutilation community is entirely theocratic. According to the World Health Organization, there are more than 125 million girls and women who have undergone female genital mutilation. 125 million women brutalized in the name of God. Okay? And that's not limited to women. Anybody know what this is? Circumcision. It's called the clinical terminology is direct orogenital suction during ritual Jewish circumcision. But that clinical terminology, it kind of obscures the true nature of what's going on here. This guy is a moel. He does the actual snipping. And this is in this country, in the 21st century. A grown man cuts off a part of an 8-day-old boy's penis, rips the skin with his fingernail, and then puts his mouth on the penis to suck off the blood. In New York City, this happens. And oftentimes, that guy has herpes that he gives to the kid. Kids have died this way, several of them. And those that don't die are obviously infected with a disease that has stigma attached to it, but can also cause very serious problems for young kids. Neonatal herpes can cause encephalitis, I believe is what it is, and that can kill you. Other serious health complications, obviously, as well. A newborn infant infected with herpes simplex from a moil by this process is 7 times more likely to die than a climber attempting Everest or a U.S. soldier during World War I. Okay? And this is in New York. The mayor just a couple weeks ago allowed this to continue. The only thing that has changed now is that the parents have to sign a paper saying that they understand the risks. That's it. So what do you care about? Do you care about homelessness and poverty and hunger? Do you want public money going to organizations that are going to buy food? Or they're going to buy Bibles. Even when religious organizations are doing good, they're often doing it for the wrong reasons. You know, a Catholic church might run a hospital, but Catholic morality is going to take precedence over giving medical care. Catholic Charities in Illinois actually used to run the adoption agencies. And in 2012, I believe, the state legalized same-sex unions. And Catholic Charities' response, since they can no longer discriminate against gay people, they closed their adoption agencies down. Rather than put children in loving homes, they were more concerned with keeping their dogma of hate. That was what they cared about, not about the kids. So, do you want money going to groups like that? Because the White House Office of Faith-Based Initiatives gives about $2 billion to groups like that every year. Bullying, child abuse, terrorism, violence, even space exploration. All of these issues have opposing religious rationales. This is televangelist Pat Robertson. His net worth is something like $200 million, maybe as much as $1 billion. He actually owns a diamond mine. Telling NASA to stop exploring because of the Bible. Stop exploring space. So I want to be clear here. I mean, religion is going to come down on the right side of issues. It's going to come down on the wrong side of issues every time, though. Martin Luther King used and was motivated by religion to a certain extent, but religion was also a huge roadblock. In his letter from the Birmingham jail, he wrote about the white churchmen who stand on the sideline and mouth pious irrelevancies and sanctimonious trivialities. So our government is built to move slowly. It's based on compromise and reasoned debate. At least that's the theory of how it's supposed to work. But religion poisons that process. It injects an ultimate truth about the world based on no evidence whatsoever that is held with absolute certainty into a debate that's supposed to be reasoned and result in compromise. So it takes what is a gray issue and makes it absolutely black and white. It poisons the debate and destroys compromise, which actually makes it a threat to democracy and the biggest barrier to progress, no matter what issues you care about. So, what can you do about it is the next question, and I'm going to let Patrick take over there.
All right, thank you, Andrew. We've been talking about a talk like this for a while because it's kind of a two-part question, which is, we all should care about these issues, but what could everyone in this room do? Obviously, there's a lot that go into movements to dealing with these issues, but there are things that people here can do. And because this is a student conference, I guess we wanted to reach out and just see if any students or anybody, I guess even 30 and younger, can stand today. Can you just stand up so we can see you? I know we're in a mixed crowd. All right, so I'm going to be speaking to you, and everybody else can listen as well. But I also, the title of this talk was Get Off Your Butt and Help Protect the Wall of Separation, so we're halfway there at this point. And I'm going to discuss a few tools that we use and that people can use, and I think the overall theme is that they're easy to do and that they are effective. And so this is from our experience in our work and also what we've observed in observing some of these state church conflicts that come up in various areas. And I guess the first thing I'll talk about is just why we're different than people who are religious. We understand that thinking to yourself is not enough. We need to do the opposite of prayer, which is to get out there and actually change things if that's what you want to happen. This is a cartoon from a cartoonist who's supportive of FFRF, and he drew this for us, which is kind of relevant because he wanted to do a prayer summit after the oil spill in the Gulf. So that's the quintessential thing that prayer's not going to fix. It's going to take either natural processes or human processes. But I think that theme fits is how are we different than religion? We know that thinking to ourselves doesn't correct these problems. So I'll talk about these, I'll call them tools, and we'll go through a few of those. And the first is just communicating with decision makers, which seems like duh, but a lot of people, and this includes people like Andrew and I and those who are younger, are very passionate and persuasive on an issue, and they write about it on Facebook, and that's their activism. They wrote about it on Facebook, or they clicked like on a page that they agree with or a news story that they agree with, and that's not really getting the full going the full distance about actually changing what matters. You need to talk to the people who are deciding these issues. And I think one of the problems that you have, those of you who are 30 years old and younger, is that you're being ignored by the people who are making decisions. The first reason why is you don't vote in the proportion that older people vote, so start doing that. And secondly, the way that you express yourself is not always directed at the people making decisions. You're writing about it on Facebook, which is getting your audience, but they're not a part of your audience. And so older people are talking to their legislators. They are in the ear of those who are making decisions. Andrew and I have the displeasure of watching government meetings from time to time. And I say that because they can be boring and they can be long. But the people who are at those meetings are not 18 years old. Those are people who are much older, and you need to be there if it's an issue that you care about. And so that's the first thing, is just communicating with the people who make decisions. And I think that's really an antidote to the area that the issues that we deal with, is having people communicate with those legislators can dilute the bad communications, but it also further your point of view. And Andrew created this, I guess, this simple, what's the best means to communicate with a decision maker? And it's face-to-face, is honestly setting up a meeting, going to their office hours. Secondly, calling them, talking to them. Third, a letter. I know that's crazy. Writing a letter. There are certain, was it Senator Graham who said he's never sent an email in his life? So keep that in mind. Some of the people that you're dealing with, they may not be using your means of communication. And we kind of took a dig at Twitter with this ranking, and I'll kind of show you why that's indicative. This is an exchange with Richard Dawkins that somebody had, and he's asking, he unblocked somebody on Twitter, and if you look at the second to last, he said, Richard Dawkins unblocks him, and then the person asks him, this is his important question, would you touch a poop for $20, is the question, and Richard Dawkins responds, oh yes, I did block you for that, and now I do so again, goodbye. And that's from, I guess, this summer. But to give a good example of in-person communication, I'll show you a photo. This is, or was, a voting booth in Wisconsin, in Brown Deer, Wisconsin. One of our FFRF members would vote here in this church with this painting there, and he took this photo, and he obviously didn't like it. He talked to election officials about it, and they said, you're right, we need to remove this. Well, the church is the owner of this building, and they said, we're not moving anything around, even though this is, you know, they're really performing a secular function at this point. So he met with city officials, and guess what? They were building a new community center in Brown Deer, and now he doesn't vote here anymore. Nobody votes here. So that was just an in-person and persuasive argument that he brought to city officials to get it changed. And this public comment kind of ties into what I've said, and this maybe also relates to a little bit of what Ed was talking about earlier, because I think this is how I envision in my head what happens sometimes on state church issues, is the kill the beast. The churches and everybody comes really angry to a school board meeting or to some other thing, and I think people that agree with us need to show up and just be there in terms of giving one comment favorably on the opposite side, because I think even reasonable legislators are very easily influenced when there's 40 people in a row saying the same thing from the angry mob that shows up. And I think it also may influence, you know, people like Jessica Elquist and others when their issue comes up and there's a couple other people that are visible that are speaking out in their favor. And I have a good example of that, too. This is a young man from Rapid City, South Dakota, who attended the College of Mines there. The city council was talking about how to add, or whether to keep prayer or Christian prayer. A whole bunch of speakers just went off like the angry mob. And he had the guts to stand up and give a very eloquent speech on the opposite side. And the room was silent. People listened to him, even though the city council ultimately didn't go in his favor, it was certainly impressive to me to see a college student go to his meeting and stand up to these religious community that was really trying to take over civic government. And so I think he's a good example of that. And another tool that you have, or that I do a lot, lawyers do a lot, has anybody filed an open records request before? So there's just a couple of you. And maybe Sam's done one. Just so you know, every state, as well as the federal government, allows you to inspect public records. So you have a right to public information on a wide variety of things, and records are very broadly defined. You have a right to that. And why that's important is that information can be used in your favor, depending on what issue you want to handle. For lawyers, we understand this. If you're in a lawsuit, there's a whole process to get information. If you're in a negotiation, the more information you have is the more ammunition you have to resolve the issue. You can certainly, it may not always be beneficial, but oftentimes you'll find something. So these records requests are something you may utilize if you're interested in a government issue and seeing what the government's actually doing. And I have we have a fun example of that recently. This is from one of our members in the Milwaukee area submitted this request to Governor Scott Walker earlier this year. It's kind of in fun, but he asks for, since your term as governor, please provide a copy transcript of all communications with God, the Lord, Christ, Jesus, or any other form of deity. And so I think this, an attorney for the governor had to respond and say, we were responding to let you know that this office does not have records responsive to your request. So it's kind of a fun example, but it in some sense proved that the governor couldn't demonstrate that he had written communications with any form of deity. And the other reason I like using records requests, and this is going to be a surprise to some of you, but people in government are liars. There are a lot of liars. Sarah Palin got the 2009 PolitiFact Lie of the Year for talking about death panels. People will tell you one thing, but there will be an actual record that says something that is the opposite of that. One example I have, this was also from a Wisconsin school district. We received pictures of a classroom that had multiple Ten Commandments posters. They had a John 3:16 poster, a Genesis poster inside the classroom, and we wrote to them saying, you can't have any of these posters. And we got a response back from an attorney for the school district saying, this is actually a part of our biblical literature curriculum, and so it's permissible. And so I'm thinking, how are they using this redacted Ten Commandments poster, this John, this doesn't make any sense. So we send a records request saying, okay, we'd like to see how you're using this in the curriculum, because it was obviously an excuse. They thought of a legal excuse as to, oh, maybe we can make this legal if it's entwined in the curriculum. And so then the response we got back was, we've removed the posters. So if you call them out on their bullshit, they may not be able to support it and will remove the, you know, we'll do as you requested. And one that I'm also a fan of, this also goes back because it's not a medium that young people are used to communicating. You write on Facebook, your 600 friends read your comment and you have an exchange and you really like it, but you're not meeting your full audience. I know a lot of people here have well thought out ideas and are persuasive writers. Why don't you submit that to a wider audience? And so papers still exist. As of 2012, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel had a circulation of 185,000. And so you could, instead of posting on Facebook, whatever issue it is, if it's a state church issue, hopefully submit that to the newspaper. And guess what? They may publish it. As I said, all of the things that we're talking about are relatively easy. I have no special knowledge as to what the Milwaukee Journal will publish. I've had editorials published in the Milwaukee Journal and in the Wisconsin State Journal. You just have to create a sound argument, submit it, and hopefully someone there will print it. I guess I have another example. I'm a canoeist. I like to canoe on the Wisconsin River. There's an owner of a canoe rental place there that wrote about farms polluting the river, like factory farms polluting the river, and submitted it to the Milwaukee Journal, and they published it. He has no scientific background. He's just a guy who runs canoes on the Wisconsin River, and he was able to get that published. So I'd say keep that in mind. You also have another resource here with the Daily Cardinal and the Badger Herald to reach your student audience if it's something about how the university is run. But I think that's something people today are missing out on and not really fully engaging in that process. This is Andrew, which is our another tool, which I guess we've labeled creative protests. He built in a very short time, and it's not pretty, a natural nativity, a natural nativity as we call it. So we this is because in the Capitol building here, religious groups put up a nativity display. There hadn't been one for a long time. And so FFRF is about two blocks from the Capitol. We said, all right, we'll play that game. And you can come up with a creative protest to make your point known. And actually, the fun part about our side is the things that you do are going to be more interesting. This is way more interesting than the nativity display that's there. And when we go to the Capitol, I walk through there frequently. People are reading our display or looking at our display. They're not looking at the nativity. And so it's something to keep in mind with being a little creative about how you approach advocacy. And you do see this sometimes now as well with people where there's literature distributions and they're distributing Bibles or they're distributing religious pamphlets. We, of course, ask that that doesn't happen if it's a public school, and sometimes the public school comes back and says, well, we're allowing everybody to distribute. Well, that's a bad idea if you have the Freedom From Religion Foundation or some group that says, all right, we'll play that game. And so you have the Satanic Temple and all these other groups that have much more fun and interesting literature participating in that forum, and then sure enough, they shut down the forum altogether. So it's a way that we engage that I think people can think outside the box. And I think the AHA group is a good example of that. They've put up displays on Bascom Hill. They've put up displays in the Capitol building, kind of also taking advantage of this theme. Well, let's be creative. And their displays are more interesting than the typical religious display you'll see. And the final tool that I'll mention that is going to sound a little bit preachy, because I'm going to talk about money, because I think that's what a lot of pastors maybe were preaching from the pulpit to seek. It's very important to join groups. Like, whatever issues you support or groups, join those groups. Like, become an actual member, whatever their criteria are. Do that. That has a lot of impact in terms of how people view that group, how that group operates. There's a lot of interesting groups that have a presence here, CFI, FFRF, the Secular Student Alliance. Become a part of these groups. And I can give, some explanation as to why I think that's important. I received a call this week from somebody who was a head of a humanist group. And she said, we're getting flack in our community because we only have 60 members. And I was thinking on the phone at the time, I was like, 60 members, that's pretty good, because a lot of people aren't interested in joining groups, especially when, you know, hey, I'm not religious, why would I join any group? But for her, even just having like-minded people in the community to say, our group is 500 members, would have been so much more important, would have been viewed with more importance in the community, just knowing, oh, this is what our ranks are, and these are people who are fully supportive of what we're doing, that they've gone through our membership process, whatever that may be. And the other part about this is there's a psychological component to either joining a group or donating money. So if you don't have the money to join, I think almost all groups have a student membership rate, donate $5. And I'll say that because, and this is something I learned in law school from a law professor in family law class, talked about what judges in Wisconsin were doing with deadbeat dads who weren't paying child support. And one of the things they would do would see what amount they could pay. And there would be court orders saying, you have to pay $5. Now, obviously, $5 is a trivial amount. It's not going to help the upbringing of that person's child. But in the eyes of the court, and it carried some responsibility with it, that these people were then taking on a responsibility for that. And I think that same principle applies when you're joining a group. And we've all heard people say, before they start, usually a really bad speech, saying, I'm a taxpayer.
is what they'll say. And so you can become a taxpayer to the groups that you are interested in by giving them a donation. And then you can come to me or Andrew and say, hey, I'm a donor to FFRF. You guys got this all wrong, or whatever, whatever the issue is. I think it's something that particularly the 30 and younger aren't doing as well as people who are older. So that's my final talk on membership. And Andrew has one final remark to make.
You want to skip that one?
Oh, I did forget this. Even the groups that talk about prayer, I said prayer was futile. They want money too. If you look at their the bottom of all of their emails, will say give now or donate is the biggest button ever. So they don't seem too confident in the pray option, number one.
So am I still audible? Okay. So I just want to talk about one more thing real quick, the last tool in your toolbox. If none of this other stuff sounds like you, if you're not comfortable writing an open records request or changing your Facebook post into a letter to the editor, there's still one thing you can do that will help more than anything else, and that is to come out of the closet. We are going to win this fight with demographics by normalizing non-belief. And this is one of the reasons that the LGBT movement has been so successful. It's because it turns out everybody knows somebody who's gay, and they're just like you and me. And the numbers actually back this up. In March 2013, a study came out, and it said that 28% of the people who now support gay marriage were once opposed. Okay, so 28% of the people changed their mind. And within that group, the biggest group by far changed their mind simply because they knew somebody who was gay. 37% of the people changed their mind on gay marriage just because they knew somebody who was gay. So everybody knows an atheist. They just don't know that they know an atheist. It's much easier to hide than being gay. All right? But it's time for us to stop hiding. So the best thing you can do for yourself is to pick up that label and wear it proudly. I'm an atheist, and I would encourage you to do that. Thank you, and I think we have time for questions.
Yeah.
All right, so we're happy to answer any and all questions you guys have. We prefer questions as opposed to personal stories. You can share those with
us
at dinner.
Just two quick questions. Outside my daughter's junior high school, there were two guys handing out Bibles. So I went in immediately to object to the principal, and she said, as long as they're doing it on the sidewalk, that's okay, as opposed to doing it in the school. Do you know if that's correct or not?
It's usually okay if it's public property. School property is not public property, but the sidewalk out in front is usually considered public property. That's considered a traditional public forum where people are allowed to exercise their free speech rights. We look at that as very, very predatory. Those are almost certainly the Gideons, and I think challenging them on that and pointing out that what they're doing is wrong. You know, parents often tell children, you know, don't take things from strangers. That's not a good idea. And then you have these two grown men out there forcing books on these kids. It's really, really upsetting and predatory behavior. We don't condone it. And we get, I don't know, probably 50 complaints about stuff like this every year.
Amen to that.
But yeah, it's a big problem.
So I mean, to get to the bulk of, I guess, the legal part of it is, we do have problems with the Gideons because they'll take whatever the school will give them. If they're allowed into the school doors or right outside the doors, they'll go there, even if it's illegal. But public sidewalks, like an actual city sidewalk that happens to be in front of a school, is a traditional public forum, which means people can distribute things there. I may not agree that there should be that zone. That's how the courts have really come down on a public sidewalk in front of a school. That wouldn't mean all sidewalks, because some schools have different layouts. But in general, and you may see this on your campuses too, the Gideons come here, they're legally allowed to do that. You're also allowed to be there and hand out materials, or to counter them, to stand there and tell students, don't take this Bible, don't take this Bible. I mean, you have that right. But it's troubling what they're doing. We're doing a lot of work in keeping them out of the inside of the classrooms, off of school property. On city property, they are probably legally permitted to be there.
My second legal question, also very short. At my son's elementary school, there was a Good News Club, and I went to object about that. The good news club, yeah. And I was told that It's not problematic because, and this was not known to me, apparently they pay for the space after school just like the YMCA does or anything else. Does that therefore make it legal since everybody's paying for it?
I mean, the short answer to that is yes.
Okay.
Religious groups are allowed to rent public schools. It's not a decision that we agree with. And let me actually pitch two things real quick. If you have questions like this on our website, there's a tab called Legal, and it's got a legal FAQ. Both of these questions are answered under that. A lot of state church questions are addressed there. Also under that tab, there is Report a Violation, which if you think there is a violation of the state and church going on in your school or your kid's school, you can report it there, and we will do our damnedest to get it stopped. But the short answer to that is yes.
Thank you. Okay, so I have a problem with my school, and it's something where you just go, like, this is giving me a headache. Get it out of here. Me and my mother tried to and my sister too, we tried to start a fandom club, but it was denied due to not being able to have a teacher instead of, I think it was in and out, instead of a parent or anybody near the school board. And in there giving us a lot of trouble. I cannot find anybody who can
sure,
do
this
it.
This is a common problem that atheist clubs face all around the country, too. So you have a student group that you want to form. You have a group of students who are interested in forming a secular student alliance at the school, for instance. And the administration says, okay, you're allowed to do that. There's actually federal law that protects it. It's called the Equal Access Act. If there is any non-curricular club in the school, so any religious club is usually a good example, then you can form your club. They will sometimes say, but you need a faculty advisor. Our stance on that is that if they are imposing that rule on you and you can't find a faculty advisor, they have to provide one. That's our stance on it. If it's a state church issue, again, report it through the FFRF legal report page, and we will take a look at it and do what we can to help you. Jesus.
Yes. Great talk as always, guys. Speaking of membership that Patrick was talking about, I wonder if you have any offhand numbers you could give to us in terms of the funding levels of some of our cultural competitors, such as the Liberty Institute, the ADF, and groups like that, because I think they're equally shocking and depressing.
I have some general ideas. I don't know how specific you can get.
I mean, I know, so there are these religious right groups that do the opposite of what we do. There are a lot more of them. They're a lot more well-funded. The last that I remember, Alliance Defending Freedom is one of the largest, which is, I believe, around $40 million a year.
I agree.
Is what they're, and this is all public information. I mean, I was talking about public records requests, but nonprofits file forms that you can look. So if you're interested in, hey, what does that group do? Look it up. I don't know the answer to ADF right now, but I thought it was in the neighborhood of $40 million.
Yeah, I think it's in the neighborhood of $40 million. American Family Association, I think, is in the neighborhood of $40 million. Liberty Institute is in the neighborhood of $4 million. Liberty Council is associated with Liberty University, which is in Virginia. You may have heard of it. They actually don't file Form 990s anymore, which is the nonprofit form, because they've declared themselves a ministry. Churches don't have to file Form 990s. And their budget with the university and Liberty Council's budget is something like $300 million. So, but we can't get exact numbers because they basically shut that down. We, in terms of funding, we are outgunned. The good news is that we are right. So every dollar you give to us is much better because we're right. Let's go over here.
So I attended a School of Tomorrow Accelerate Christian Education School for about 6 years, and they taught misogyny, homophobia, racism. They taught me that South African apartheid ending was a bad thing for black people. My curiosity is, first of all, the voucher question. Where are we on that? What can we do about that? And second of all, how is it that we're allowed, people are allowed to teach this, and that's an education that goes on to college, ACT, so on and so forth. Shouldn't there be checks against teaching children homophobia?
Yeah, I can answer that. Andrew called me the voucher expert. I'm just a person who's been interested in it, so I've been writing on it and reading about it for a while.
It's a timely question that you ask, because I assume most of the people in here are Wisconsin residents, or at least attending school at the University of Wisconsin. The lid is about to be blown off on school vouchers in Wisconsin. The governor submitted a budget bill, which is for a two-year budget cycle, that would uncap the limit on vouchers statewide. So right now, we've been dealing with, for about 20 years, vouchers in Milwaukee, more recently vouchers in Racine, and in a smaller program to send students to voucher schools, statewide, which is capped at 1,000 students. That cap is proposed to be removed in the current state budget. So what you can do about this is contact your legislator and say, don't remove the cap on vouchers, actually shut down vouchers. To the second part of your question, which is a harder answer, is, you know, how do they get away with teaching this? I guess there's not a lot of state oversight. And it seems to be designed that way because religious schools don't want the state telling them what to teach or not to teach. I happen to have looked at some of the curriculum in schools, voucher schools that we pay for as taxpayers in Milwaukee, and there's a school there that has seventh grade health curriculum that teaches about the sins of homosexuality. That's in their health curriculum, and about the man-made idea of evolution. So this is being taught right now in Wisconsin schools that we pay for. There's not a good means to address it because there's not state oversight. So the best way to address it is to stop the funding that we're giving them.
As a dues-paying member of FFRF, I just wanted to say one thing. Please keep doing what you're doing because it's badly needed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for your support.
I totally just remembered what I was going to say.
Go for it.
Okay, so like 2 years ago, my school had a German class where you could learn German stuff, and that's one of the curriculums that they often practically require schools to teach. I mean, like, almost every school has it. Well, I found out that it was cut due to finances, and last year we didn't have many clubs. This year we all of a sudden have, like, a ton of clubs I've never heard of, even though I've asked for a huge list of them. We only had, like, 12. And the stuff we are receiving for the clubs is very little, but I've been hearing that we've got huge check for the school cafeteria, even though still now the food is really bad. And we got a huge check for like stuff in general just to help everything get better. I have not seen many improvements at all except for extra random, not very useless clubs being put up. And the Christian club, yeah, there's a Christian club. It's freaking Wisconsin.
Well, if there's a Christian club, then you can start your club.
Yeah.
That's the first thing. The second thing about the funding of the schools, I'm just going to bring this back to vouchers, actually, because vouchers are a sideways attack on public education. They're not only funding religious education, which is problematic, but they're taking the money out of public schools. And that's done deliberately. And it is one of the reasons that the Catholic Church and these other religious groups are pushing for vouchers. It's not just so they can get money, it's so that they can undercut education, because education drives people away from religion. And it is done to make public education worse. They don't ever talk about that, but if you look, just scratch below the surface, it is certainly there.
Okay. Well, we good on time, sir?
I have one, yeah.
Oh, one more.
Real quick one.
Can you talk about the IRS and if they're cracking down on politics in the pulpit?
Yeah, I can.
Where?
I don't think they're cracking down on it. So, I mean, you must be familiar. FFRF, we have, it's probably not smart, but we've had 3 lawsuits against the IRS.
The audit's coming anyway.
And one of those relates to, and one of the conditions on being a nonprofit is that you're not going to advocate for or against the election of candidates for office. It's a privilege to be a nonprofit, so we shouldn't be funneling money through nonprofits to do political work. Churches, and specifically we mentioned this Alliance Defending Freedom, encourage churches to do that advocacy from the pulpit. And so we brought a lawsuit because the IRS at least seemed to not be doing anything about it. As a part of that lawsuit, We ended up getting information that showed there is a review process, and there are churches that they seem to be investigating. So right now, publicly, there hasn't been anything announced. At least behind the scenes, it seems that there may be some action taken on this in the future. At the same time, I say that the campaign on the religious side is getting bigger. You know, they're still doing advocacy from the pulpit for or against candidates.
Well, they're actually challenging the IRS to come after them.
Yes, they're begging the IRS.
They've mailed video recordings of their preaching to the IRS. So it's like this, I dare you to revoke my nonprofit status. So at some point, there's gonna be a clash between a church that's doing that and the IRS. It's just we don't know when that would be.
Give it up for Andrew and Patrick.